This modern twister string derived, a twister string inspired methods to calculate scattering amplitudes in gauge theory. And I will talk mainly about applications to loop level. And the talk is mainly based on this paper from last October with Bill Spence and Gabriele Cavaglini, who is in the audience back from Queen Mary. And it's also loosely based on a series of earlier papers, of which the latest paper is kind of a generalization. Okay, so let me give an outline of my talk. I will start with some motivation and aims, give you the general slogans, why this is interesting to do, then introduce some background, some general tools to calculate scattering amplitudes in gauge theory, things like color decomposition, spin elasticity, formalism. And then I will introduce the more modern techniques based on ideas from twister string theory and twister space, and then introduce to you the MHV diagrams, which are very powerful on radio free level. And then the next step, I will explain how these methods can be extended to the one loop level in supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric gauge theories. And then in the last part of my talk, I will try to show that there's some quite general equivalence between traditional Feynman diagrams and this MHV diagram, at least at the one loop level. And I will give this proof in three steps, starting with a proof of covariance of MHV loop diagrams using a little known theorem from field theory, the so-called Feynman tree theorem, which I will explain, and then we will check that this formalism reproduces all the right discontinuities of the amplitudes, and we'll also check certain factorization limits to make sure that it really gives the right answer. And then we'll end with some conclusions and outlook possible further applications of this story. So this recent development started with a quite interesting proposal by Witten in 2003, who relates perturbative N equal 4 superimpulse, so weakly coupled gauge theory, to topological string theory on a supersymmetric version of twister space. And this is kind of a weak duality, and you might ask, why is this really interesting? In principle, you can calculate on both sides. What would you really learn from that? But this has very interesting applications, both conceptually and also has many practical applications. More conceptual question is that it helps to explain this unexpected simplicity of scattering amplitudes that we observe in gauge theory and also in gravity theories. And somehow this twister picture, once we translate amplitudes into twister variables, we see a very simple geometric structure. They localize some amplitudes localized in simple algebraic curves. And this also led to new types, novel differential equations, which are obeyed by amplitudes. But maybe more importantly, these developments gave us a bunch of new, very efficient techniques to calculate in practice. And here are the three main offsprings, I would say, the MHV diagrams, which work for tree and loop level, which are the techniques which are most directly linked to the twister string idea of Witten.
Sorry, Christian, would you mind putting on the light a little bit? Oh, great.
And later on, other techniques have been developed, which let's say inspired by these twister developments, like generalized unitarity, extremely powerful. You get loop amplitudes, for example, n equal 4 units. That one loop is basically reduced to algebra. And it also has led to very powerful new recursion relations, which work at three level, both in masters and massive cage theories, but also in gravity, for example. But even more importantly, they also work at the loop level and led to the calculation of new amplitudes in QCD, which haven't been obtained previously. So let's come to motivation. But one of the most important motivations, of course, is that LHC is coming in 1 or 2 years. It will be turned on, and we will need precision perturbative QCD calculations of a precision which we haven't obtained yet. And there exist long wish lists of experimentalists of processes that have to be calculated. And new techniques are really urgently needed to obtain this result. And the reason is that, well, traditional Feynman rules are really lousy at calculating amplitudes. They're highly inefficient. They lead to huge intermediate expressions, which are often much larger than the final result. And you also have to deal with the factorial growth of the number of diagrams. So here's an example of 2 gluons scattering into m gluons at the tree level. You would have to sum these numbers of diagrams. And well, I think nobody has ever done this in practice with traditional Feynman diagram techniques. So over the years, people have developed better techniques to deal with these problems. For example, they've introduced color decomposition. They have used spinohelicity techniques, which I will also explain later. They've used unitarity, which is very powerful, supersymmetry. Other string theory techniques, for example, the first calculation of the 4-point Young scattering amplitudes in N equal 4 super Young nodes was done by Green, Schwartz, and Brink using string theory. And now, since 2004, we have seen many interesting developments inspired or partially derived by twister string theory. Now I will explain some of the important tools that we will need in the talk, and one of them is so-called color decomposition, meaning that at tree level, the full gluon scattering amplitude can be written in this form as a sum over the single trace structures which contain the color information times this so-called partial or color strip amplitudes. That's a very neat way to factor out all the color dependence. And it's really these partial amplitudes we will focus on that we will calculate. Labor themselves a gauge invariant, so they're somehow the smallest gauge invariant objects you can calculate. But they have the advantage, they only have contributions from a subset of all the Feynman diagrams, namely those where the external lines have fixed cyclic ordering. And hence, also the analytic structure is simpler, the functional form is simpler. And at tree level, this is actually all we have to consider. At loop level, actually, also multi-trace structures would show up, which are subtly in 1 over n. But at one loop level, there exists a simple relation between the planar and these non-planar terms. So actually, it's sufficient to calculate these partial amplitudes at the planar level. Any question? Next important formalism is the spinohelicity formalism, which is really the ideal tool or variables to treat massless gauge theories. And these variables really lead to the most compact formulas for gauge theory and gravity amplitudes at tree and loop level, and also very convenient for practical calculations. And they're based on the simple fact that in 4 dimensions, a 4 vector can be written as a bispinor. Here we have the 4 index running from 0 to 3 here. With a 2x2 matrix with this A and A dot indices, these are left and right handed spinor indices running from 1 to 2. Relation is simply given by Pauli matrices. And now if you describe massless on-shell states, then P squared must vanish, which translates for this 2x2 matrix in the condition that the determinant vanishes, and hence PA dot can be written as a product of 2 vectors, or actually we call them spinor variables, lambda and lambda quibble. And if you can complexify Minkowski space, then these spinors would be really independent. However, in real Minkowski space, which is of course most relevant for physics, the lambda twiddle variables are related to the lambda variables by complex conjugation, of course. And then with the spinors, one can easily build a Lorentz invariant product using a Lorentz invariant epsilon tensor. One introduces these brackets, namely these angle brackets for the contraction of left-handed spinors and these angle brackets for right-handed spinors. And then one can write the dot product of two on-shell momenta, EI dot BJ, as a product of these spinor products. In the real power of these variables comes from the fact that they're really the correct number of degrees of freedom to describe both the wave function or the polarization vector plus the momentum of an on-shell gluon or fermion, while if we were to use the more conventional four momenta, which is a highly redundant set of variables and leads to much bigger expressions. Now let's look at the simplest gluon three level scattering amplitudes that exist. There are two infinite series, one where all the external gluons have the same helicity, or there's another infinite series where only one of the external lines has opposite helicity and they vanish, and the first non-vanishing infinite series of amplitudes is these are the so-called MHV or maximal helicity violating amplitudes, and they have like mainly plus helicity gluons and exactly two negative helicity gluons at arbitrary position I and j. And they're described by this very simple and compact beautiful formula, which was conjectured by Park and Taylor and later proven by Behrens and Chi. And while I mentioned it's already extremely simple, another important feature, which is important later for the factorization properties, that it is holomorphic. You see this ratio here depends only on the angle brackets and these lambda twiddles, which are the complex conjugate of lambda in real Minkowski space, don't show up. They only show up here at this momentum conservation factor duration. And these formulas are correct in any gauge theory, supersymmetric or not, or even QCD. And in any book for there exist similar simple formulas for amplitudes where two of the gluons or more replace the fermions or scalars and that chart. Any questions? Now here the please short this introduction. Twister space very simple minded and contains just information we really need. And you can really think of it as a one half Fourier transform from this spinor variables which describe on-shell particles. We have left and right-handed spinors, and say we just do a Fourier transform on the right-handed spinors lambda twiddle, turn it into some new variable, u a dot, that takes you basically to twister space, is complex dimensional, if you wish. But since, as it turns out, amplitudes are really homogeneous functions on twister space, so they are functions of a particular degree, and this degree is related to the helicity of given particle. It's sufficient to really consider only projective twister space CP3, which is obtained by identifying lambda mu and the multiplication of a non-vanishing complex number T. And another ingredient that we will need is, which will be important later, is the important relation between objects in Minkowski space and in projective twister space. And this comes from this famous incidence relation for twister theory, which is given by this equation. This is just two linear equations for mu and lambda. And there are two ways to read this equation. You can either fix x at a point in Minkowski space, then you see this becomes a two linear equations for this mu number variables, and they live in CP3, a complex three-dimensional manifold. So you get one complex one-dimensional object, and it's just called a line in twister space. It's just a Riemann sphere, basically. Or you can keep mu and lambda fixed, choose a point in projective twister space, and it fixes a null plane in Minkowski space, a so-called alpha plane. But it's mainly the first relation you will need. Now it's an interesting exercise to take some known amplitude and transform that to twister space and see what happens there. And if you do this for the MHV amplitudes, this transformation, this Fourier transform amplitude is very simple, because the interesting part of the amplitude is holomorphic and doesn't enter this Fourier integration at all. It just factors out in front. And here we have written the remaining momentum conservation delta function as an integration of x times this exponential factor. Then we have the exponential factor coming from the Fourier transforms. And you see this is an exponent is linear in lambda twiddle. So you easily end up with a bunch product of delta functions, which just implies that the MHV amplitude is only non-vanishing when all points which correspond each to a particular gluon sit on the same line in twister space. So this gives this important localization property of MHV amplitudes on the line in twister space. Any questions so far? Now, Wittgen's conjecture actually extended to, in principle, to general L-loop amplitudes with Q-negative helicity gluons, which he proposed have to localize on curves of a particular degree, Q minus 1 plus L. So if you are tree-level, this degree is given by the number of negative helicity gluons, so minus 1, and it gives this conjecture gave a bound of the genus of the curve bounded by the number of loops. And then one can take just well-known amplitudes in the literature and test their twister space localization properties. And for this one can consider particular differential operators. And what was found by actually experiments that non-MHV amplitudes, many amplitudes with three or more negative helicity gluons localize on intersections of lines in twister space. For example, amplitudes with three negative helicity gluons localize in intersection of two lines. If you have four negative helicity gluons on intersections of three lines and so forth. Very simple geometric structure. As we've seen, the MHV amplitudes localize on the line in twister space, but then according to Penrose's incidence relation, a line in twister space corresponds to a point in space-time, and so it's kind of natural to think of MHV amplitudes of kind of local interactions. And that led Kachalski, Virchik, and Wittgen to propose new diagrammatic rules to calculate three-level amplitudes using exactly those MHV amplitudes as local vertices, effective vertices, which have to be continued off-field in a particular way, which I explain in a moment. And then you just have to connect these MHV vertices with scalar propagators and sum of all individual diagrams which have fixed cyclic order of external lines. For example, you wish to calculate a six-point amplitude with three negative helicity gluons, which are here 1, 2, 3, which with Feynman rules would take 220 Feynman diagrams. You have to, with these new rules, you just have to sum simple diagrams of that form where 2MHV vertices agreed with a scalar propagator. The only new thing we have to understand is how to continue this internal leg off shell where principally the momentum is off shell where p squared doesn't where p doesn't square to zero. And it was found that the correct off shell continuation is basically a projection of the off shell momentum, the written spinor notation, on some reference spinor. This gives you some new spinor lambda VA. You plug this into the Park-Taylor formula, and this gives you the correct prescription for the calculation. And there's some more diagrams you will have to sum up in this process. And well, it reproduces all the known results that were known previously, led to many new expressions for scattering amplitudes in master stage theories, and there's a dramatic simplification because you have much less diagrams to sum up, and the individual expressions are much smaller. These calculations can be done on one or two pages, and they also give all the correct factorizations that you expect from these amplitudes on multi-particle poles and collinear soft limits, where collinear limit, for example, the momentum of external gluons become parallel, and usually certain poles sharpen in the amplitudes, and the soft limit is a limit where one of the external momenta is just taken to zero. A really important step in the proof of this prescription is really that the dependence on this reference spinor that you have to introduce for this off-shell continuation, which breaks Lorentz invariance term by term, at the end of the day disappears once you sum up all the diagrams. And the chances were even given they're able to show this already in their paper. But that's an important issue that also will pop up in the story about Wondorf amplitudes. So let's summarize roughly the story about MHV diagrams. Many further amplitudes have been calculated, including fermions and scalars. Amplitudes with quarks and fundamental representation have been calculated. Even phenomenologically interesting processes with including Higgs's were calculated, and including electroweak vector boson currents. And the last couple of months we have seen first steps of a Lagrangian derivation of these rules using particular gauge fixings and some kind of like a transformation of the field variables. Any questions so far on the tree level story? Then let's go on to loops. There, the story was originally not as promising because in twister string theory, we not only have modes that describe gauge fields, but there are also a couple of conformal supergravity modes, which one can in principle ignore if you do tree level calculations, but if you try to do a loop calculation, it would start running in the loop and most likely spoil the correspondence. So in our paper in 2004, we said we try anyway and use these MHV rules as kind of field theoretic rules and try to extend those rules to the loop level. So again, the idea is to take MHV vertices, connect an appropriate number of them by scalar propagators, with the appropriate off-field continuation. Well, you have to find the appropriate measure to do then the loop integration and perform the appropriate loop integration and dimensional regularization, which is needed here because of infrared divergences. So the first thing we did is to take an example where the result is known to test this method, and the simplest example is the MHV one loop amplitude in N equal 4 super young nodes. Which in this method you would calculate by gluing 2MHV, 3-level vertices connected by 2 scalar propagators, and then you have to sum all the individual diagrams and also sum over all the internal helicity states that can run in the loop, and finally do a loop integration. But these amplitudes have been calculated 10 years ago by Bernd Dings and Dunn Kloster using the method of four-dimensional cup constructibility, which works in massless supersymmetric gauge theories, at least at one loop by any amplitude. Basically, an application of unitarity. And the result is very compact, very simple, turns out to be just the MHV three-level amplitude times the sum of so-called box integral functions, which arise in an effective scalar phi-free theory, so they're just three scalar propagators in loop integration. And this external lines mean here that you take a collection of momenta of external gluons and put them here on one corner, and then you get the momentum generically in this corner that is off shell. So these corners are called massive. It turns out that only such box topologies show up where you have two massive corners, two massless corners. These are called Thomas easy box functions. Well, the exercise was now to reproduce this result of the MHV vertices, and again, schematically, we have loop integration times two MHV vertices, where two internal legs are from the off shell. And for the measure, we just took really the simplest thing here for the measure, just the usual loop measure. And we also put the scalar propagators that connect these MHV vertices into the measure. And here we have a momentum conservation delta function from one of the vertices. And just use the same option for continuation as before, which in for four momenta can be written like this. And off shell L loop momentum L mu can be written as a sum of an on shell little L mu four vector plus a real number set times some reference null vector. And in these variables, for example, one of these measure factors here turns into this product of a kind of dispersive piece, which is DC of a set, times the one particle phase space measure. And if you collect this together with the second factor and integrate out a linear combination of this real parameters, C1 plus C2, then you arrive at this measure here, which contains a piece which is a two-particle Lorentz invariant phase space measure. That's the measure you usually use when you calculate unitarity cuts using the Minkowski rule. Well, the only new thing here is that the momentum flow through this cut is not the naive sum of momenta that run through this cut, but it's actually a shift here by proportional to this reference vector times this real number C. And then there's a piece that looks very much like a dispersive measure. Now, after some spinner gymnastics, what we found is that in the sum over integrals, we find all the two-particle cuts, or unitarity cuts, of these Thomas easy boxes. They're indicated in different colors. And the remaining piece of work is then to do the remaining dispersion integrals, and actually also show that the dependence on this reference spinner, which is still showing up at intermediate steps, disappears. And actually, if you combine all the four cuts contributing to such a Thomas easy box, you realize originally only numerically that this interdependence goes away. So we found that the final result agrees with the own computation of Bernd Dickson done by Cosimer, was this calculation for breaks huge numbers of conventional finite diagrams. And surprisingly, naturally it led to dispersion type of integrals, so made some unexpected connections with the old S matrix approach. And it also provides an alternative check of the MHV diagram method with its proof of covariance, so the independence on this reference vector is a highly non-trivial exercise. And then I will later show how you can extend the proof of covariance to non-MHV amplitudes at quantum. And it also led to a slightly simpler form of the two-mass easy box function, which contains these infrared divergent terms plus a sum of four dialogue rings.
But I wouldn't say that it's slightly simpler. I would say that it's a remarkably simpler expression, because the other one has five dialogue rings.
Plus an ugly log.
And here you just got rid of the logs and only four dialogue rings. They have nice behavior under everything.
Yeah, the advantage is that they lend themselves to easier analytic continuation if you move from Euclidean signature to real Minkowski signature. Also, they make manifest this story that this two-mass easy box function is made up of four pieces coming from four dispersion integrals, which is not manifest in the other form. And actually, there's also an all-order epsilon generalization of this formula, where these dialogues are replaced by some hypergeometric functions depending on AP squared, AQ squared, AS, AT. So this approach can also easily be expanded to either non-MHV amplitudes or theories with less supersymmetry. We focused on reducing the number of supersymmetries, and first we looked at one-loop amplitudes and n equals one superluminals. Again, the MHV type is two negative helicity gluons externally. And here we consider not really having an n equals one vector multiplet running in a loop, but thanks to this supersymmetric decomposition for one-loop amplitudes, we can write this as a contribution from the n equals four multiplet, which we calculated already, minus three times the contribution from the current multiplet, which contains the fermion, a complex scalar. And the story is, in practice, very similar, just technically more involved, and leads to a result that also involves scalar box functions, actually the finite scalar box functions, plus new types of integral functions, so-called triangles. And again, the result agrees with an old calculation by Bernd Dickson done by Cosimer. And okay, schematically, the answer is here. Again, the result is proportional to the tree level on MHV amplitude times the sum of integral functions, but the result is much more complicated now. Well, we have these box functions as well as triangle functions. In addition, you have here non-trivial coefficients appearing in front of these integral functions, which I didn't show. In the case of n equals 4, these coefficients here were all 1, which are set to sum over all possible two-mass easy boxes. And you can even push this to some extent to non-supersymmetric theories. The problem that comes in here is that non-supersymmetric theories are not 4D cut constructible. This mainly means that the amplitude not only contains these integral functions like boxes or triangles, which contain dialogues, products of logs, or logarithms, which have these continuities, but also contain rational terms that look more like tree-level amplitudes, and they cannot be fixed with unitarity. And it also turns out that exactly these terms we missed with this MHV diagram method. Nevertheless, you can get all the cut-containing terms from the MHV vertices. And for this, we again use this supersymmetric decomposition. For example, if you want to know a wonder band loop where everyone is running into loop view, and now break is down into contribution from an n equal 4 multiplied that we calculated already, subtract 4 times contributions from an n equal 1 current multiplied, also calculated already, and we're left with a scalar running in the loop, which is also, if you would use conventional Feynman rules, it's much easier, much simpler, because the tensor structures are much easier than if you would try directly to calculate the gluon contribution. Anyway, the result, again, is expressed in terms of box functions and a set of triangle functions. And the results we found agreed with any result that had been obtained earlier, but we also found a new result, namely we found the NHV on the magnitudes with the two negative felicity gluons in arbitrary position that hadn't been calculated before, only the case where they are nearest neighbors. But that really gives a first new result for QCD from these NHV diagrams. And if you ask what about these rational terms, which are still missing, they are now being calculated by other groups using other twister string-inspired techniques, so-called recursion relations. So soon we will have complete amplitudes from these methods. Any questions so far? I will now go to the more general story. But first, I'll just summarize the evidence for this NHV diagram method so far. At three level, this story is really complete. There exist several proofs from the original authors, Kachatas, Virgil, Witten, or very good Kachatas, Feng. We could prove it also via these recursion relations. And Wiesager found a very nice proof of this MHV diagrams, who realized that this MHV diagram method is actually just a particular case of a recursion relation, and other recursion relations, they by construction give correct covariant answers. And at one loop level, okay, we have some circumstantial evidence from explicit calculations of these MHV amplitudes in n equal 4 superior wheels, n equal 1, and for the coupling structural part in pure wheels. The one I then ask a more bold question: do these MHV diagrams provide a new complete perturbative expansion of at least supersymmetric gauge theories? And in the following, I want to present some evidence for this at the one loop level, and for generic one loop amplitudes with an arbitrary number of negative felicity gluons on the external lines. So far, we had only done one loop amplitudes with two negative felicity gluons in external lines. And the proof will proceed in three steps. First, I want to show that summing up all these MHV diagrams at one loop level gives covariant answers, answers that do not depend on this reference phenom or vector. That's really the hardest part, or at least was fast. This really made us sweat to show this. In our original paper, we really only had a numerical proof. And it seemed really hard to find a quick proof, but there we will use the so-called Feynman tree theorem to find a quite elegant proof. And then we will check that the answers have the correct discontinuities. Again, the amplitudes come with dialogues, logarithms, and it's quite easy to check that we get those functions right. And then there's still some ambiguity left that would be rational functions that we miss, and we check those by considering certain kinematic limits of the amplitude and see that we get the right thing. Okay, let's go to step one of the proof, and that proceeds with the help of the Feynman tree theorem, which is based on this simple observation that the usual Feynman propagator, which is not a causal propagator, can be decomposed into, say, a retarded propagator, which only propagates stuff into the future, plus an on-shell delta function, which for this decomposition, this delta function here, this minus indicates that you have to pick the negative energy solution. And then you can imagine that start doing Feynman diagrams, not using the good old Feynman propagator, but the retarded propagator, you quickly see that at loop level, something interesting will happen because of the fact that this retarded propagator only propagates stuff into the future. And any loop integral with local vertices, that's the only important ingredient here, that you have point like interactions with each vertex. So this integral then must be localized on this equation. And of course, you can obey this identity only if you have closed family curves. And of course, in usual Minkowski space, we don't have such. So the integral must simply vanish. And now we can take this vanishing result and rewrite the recovery propagator again in terms of the Feynman propagator plus a delta function. So then you have here this, well, we consider only one loop integral. This factor f contains all the vertices, and then we rewrite the recovery propagator. This sum and the product of these. And then we explode this product, and the term we're really interested in is where you have only Feynman propagators. So we, in this equation, we could put this on the left-hand side, and we find that the one-loop integral with Feynman propagators can be written as this integral, where this primely denotes that if, when you explode this product, at least one internal propagator is replaced by an on-shell delta function. But in actual, this means that the Feynman tree theorem reduces the loop calculation to three diagrams, which, however, still have to be phase-space integrated. Or in other terms, we have reduced the one-loop calculation to the sum of all possible cuts of that particular diagram. Any questions to that? As immediate that, as we mentioned earlier, we can think of MHV amplitudes and vertices as point-like interactions in Minkowski space. We can apply this also directly to MHV diagrams. And this gives a really nice proof of covariance of the MHV diagram method. Again, the idea is that, okay, amplitude, which is now given as a sum of MHV one-loop diagrams, actually can be decomposed as a sum for one cut, two particle cut, three particular, and four particle cut. And then we just have to show that each of these contributions themselves is covariant. But we will basically use here, once you cut the one-loop, once you cut the loop open, you only deal with tree amplitudes, and for tree amplitudes, we know already that the MHV diagram method gives covariant answers. And the remaining thing you do here is phase-space integrations, which come with covariant phase-space meshes, so the result will be covariant. So let's look at the simplest example, which we have tested already by explicit calculation. MHV one-loop amplitudes, and we glue here two MHV vertices with scalar propagators, and I here suppressed all external gluon lines. In this case, we just get a one particle and two particle cut diagrams of that type. So for two particle cuts, the story is really simple. Both lines are cuts, so we get on both sides of the cut an on-shell MHV scattering amplitude, which is covariance, of course, and this has to be integrated over two particles of phase space measure, which is also covariant. So the contribution from here is automatically covariant. A bit more thought is needed for the one particle cuts, because if I sum over these one cut diagrams, this does not give all the diagrams that would contribute, say, to the next to MHV tree level amplitude that you should get from this cut here. But it turns out that, so what we need to get the next MHV twiddler lamp. It would be MHV diagram where both cut lines come from the same MHV vertex. But a careful study shows that actually either these contributions from these diagrams actually give zero in supersymmetric theories. This can be easily shown. Once a sum over these internal helicities that contribute here. Or one can also show that actually this expression, because these two legs here are actually collinear, give also a covariant expression. So in any case, the story is fine, and also the one particle cuts give covariant expressions. And about more complicated examples go along the same lines. I just hint here how this would work for the next two MHV amplitudes. They have three negative helicity gluons. In this case, we glue three MHV vertices. At one loop, two topologies of diagrams appear, this triangle diagram, and then this bubble connected with another MHV vertex. And for example, for the two particle cuts, we get now two kinds of objects, so a cut triangle, and two particle cut of that object gives that. So on one side, you get an MHV amplitude, which is covariant already by itself. And on the other side of the cut, you get diagrams that contribute to the calculation of an extra MHV trilateral amplitude, and you exactly get all the diagrams you need for that. Once you do that sum, you get a covariant expression. You're just left with the covariant phase-space integrations. And so the story for the triple cut, well, that's really trivial. Then you get three-level MHV amplitudes. And for the one-particle cuts, well, you again have to consider these missing diagrams. But the story, again, okay, you get covariant expressions. Any question to that? If not, then we move on to check that these MHV diagrams give expressions that have the correct discontinuity, so unitarity of cuts in all channels. And that's actually quite easy because the diagrammatic is really identical to the one used for the Feynman two particle cuts in the Feynman tree theorem. So again, if you pick a particular channel, you basically say you pick diagrams with two particular scalar propagators, and then you sum up all diagrams that have these two propagators in common. And on both sides, you will get a sum of MHV diagrams, which again sum the covariant expression and your tree amplitudes, and then the phase space integration just reproduces the correct discontinuities, and that actually also works for generalized cuts, triple cuts, and portable cuts. As I mentioned, this is just a small side remark that although the diagrammatics really look identical in a Feynman two-particle cut, it's really something different from a unitary two-particle cut. The reason is that in usual Tarkovsky rules for the unitarity two particle cut, the energy of the particles that flow through the cut both must have positive energy, but the same energy. But because in the Feynman tree theorem, we use these delta functions which are connected to this. For the direction of this arrow, you actually have here a particle with positive and one with negative energy flowing through the cut. It's actually, while the unitarity cut is non-vanishing above threshold, actually the Feynman cut is non-vanishing below threshold. Anyway, by now we have checked that we get covariant formulas with all the correct generalized cuts. So all functions which have discontinuities, like dialogues or logs, have been fixed. We also have seen that expression is eta independent. So unphysically eta dependent singularities or cuts also cannot show up. But still, there could be rational terms which we haven't fixed yet. And we want to check for those. And once we have fixed rational terms, the remaining ambiguity, if there's any, would be a polynomial term. But the dimension of the amplitude is 4 minus n. So they can be ruled out by dimensional grounds. So to check for these rational terms, we now look at certain kinematic limits when the amplitudes become singular. The collinear limits where two adjacent, the moment of two adjacent gluons A and B become collinear or parallel. And at one loop, the following thing happens. An endpoint, one of the amplitude, then factorizes into two terms, which are composed of a splitting three-level amplitude, where the splitting amplitude only depends on the helicities of these two gluons here, times a one-loop amplitude with one leg less, plus the one-loop splitting amplitude times the three-level amplitude with one leg less. And the main task is really now to reproduce these splitting functions correctly. As mentioned, that is three and one loop splitting functions given by these formulas, where this set here denotes the momentum fraction carried by the leg A, and one minus set is the momentum fraction carried by gluon B in the limit where the sum of the momenta A and B goes on shell. That's the limit when they become parallel. And at one loop, these splitting functions are just given by the three-level splitting function times the universal function, which is known to all orders in the dimensional regularization parameter epsilon, was derived by these solutions and takes this form. When we use symmetry diagrams to calculate this collinear limits, we have to consider basically two cases in the MHV diagram method. That comes from the fact that MHV diagrams treat positive and negative helicities in an asymmetric fashion. And there are collinear limits where the number of negative helicity gluons is preserved, like 2 plus helicities can go into 1 plus, or plus minus goes into minus. I call them A-type, and there are also B-type collinear limits where the number of negative helicity gluons is reduced. And in order to see a singularity at all, this is a generic feature, both legs that become collinear must end on the same MHV vertex. You only get contributions from such diagrams. On the loop level, this distinction between A and B types was done already three-level by Freddy and collaborators, but this also has been done at the one-loop level, and there we have to consider so-called singular channel and non-singular channel MHV diagrams. Singular channel diagrams contribute to the one-loop splitting functions, and I've given an example here. The very special diagrams, the legs A and B end on the same MHV vertex, but this MHV vertex has to be a four-point vertex. And the internal loop legs then have to connect through the same internal MHV vertex. But if there would be more external lines connected to this vertex here, then this would be non-singular channel diagram, which only contributes to the three-level splitting function. And I think I've mentioned most of the things here already. The interesting thing is that this calculation actually can be done to all orders in the dimensional regularization parameter. That this was unexpected for us, and our result agrees with the previous earlier calculations. And as I said, the contribution to the three-level splitting function is obtained from non-singular channel diagrams, where you have more than two external gluons connected to this vertex. And for the D-type collinear limits, you have to consider even more special diagrams. And for the one-loop splitting function, you have to consider such diagrams, where again, the two legs are connected to the four-point vertex, which connect to another vertex. But in this case, this second vertex has to be a three-point MHV vertex. And the contributions from this object here give you, again, the all-order in epsilon expression for the one-loop splitting function. So this means that the collinear limits work out fine. And we then checked also so-called soft limits, where the momentum of the gluon labeled S goes to zero. And in this case, there exist similar factorization formulas. So the endpoint amplitude then goes into so-called soft soft function times an n minus 1.1 loop amplitude plus the one loop soft function times an n minus 1.3 amplitude. Well, here's the three level soft function, and the one loop soft function again is given in terms of the three results times some universal function, which is known to all orders in epsilon. And also there, we were able to reproduce the all order result from MHV diagrams, and there we have to consider these three diagrams, for example, consider to study this limit, the all the three external. Well, this gluon A is like the one before S and one after the leg S that to be included. Anyway, this brings me then to the conclusions. We have seen that MHV diagrams are very efficient to calculate for the tree level and at one loop level in supersymmetric cage theories, but also in non-supersymmetric theories. You can get at least these up-constructible parts and quartic pieces of the full amplitude. In supersymmetric gauge theories at one loop level, we have shown that we always get covariant expressions using the finite tree theorem. We always get the correct unitarity to generalize the cuts. And we have checked several kinematic limits. And also, outstanding problem to check, for example, multiparticle poles to get a full, complete proof of this statement. And for the potential further applications of this finite tree theorem, one of them I didn't mention yet, but the one-loop measure that we kind of had to postulate in our first paper can be basically derived in a very nice, neat way from the finite tree theorem. And I think the finite tree theorem also should have further applications because it's a very general statement. It also works in particular for massive particles. And these new techniques up to now still have been mainly developed for massless theories, at least at the loop level. And it would be quite nice to get also a handle on processes including massive particles, which are important for phenomenology, of course. And what we also have seen, that MHV diagrams kind of seem to work better than expected. What I mean by that is we found the all-order epsilon expressions for the one-loop splitting and soft function, and also the four-point one-loop amplitude in any of four supernumerals is obtained to all orders in epsilon. That's kind of surprising. We actually generally only expect the answer to be right up to terms with positive powers of epsilon. And this should imply that to some degree the MHV diagram should also be able to use them for higher loops. That's something we have looking at the moment to two loops, maybe three loops. And well, there should then also be interesting connections with interoperability. And this recent advances towards higher loop recursion relations for planar amplitudes and angle four supernumbers. Thank you, that's all.
Suppose that you take many, many negative Felicity grooms.
Mm-hmm.
So next to image we have things like that. So you would expect to have maybe hexagons and heptagons and things like that, right? So wouldn't you think that perhaps this is hinting that there might be a better basis of integrals than just using boxes for one loop amplitudes? I mean, instead of reducing all these guys down to boxes, maybe. Maybe this is telling you that there is a smarter choice of basis.
Well, might well be, but I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
No, it's just a thought.
But in practice, the method becomes harder and harder as you increase the number of negative Felicity gluons. It was just an in principle question. Is this really a new diagrammatic?
Well, maybe
replacing finite diagrams.
Maybe it becomes harder and harder because you're trying to reduce it to the boxes.
It's not easy to match the integral to the integrals of the box function you expect to go up.
That's what I'm saying.
The problem is only that the results that we know at the moment are given in terms of this box function, so if you want to compare with. But it might be a good idea to try to find first a better basis and then.
So the other question would be, well, in one of these attempts of proving that the MHV diagrams come from a Lagrangian, basically, maybe this approach of Mason, that if they claim they have proved that the two Lagrangians are just different gauge fixes, yes, the Japanese Lagrangian and the Lagrangian that produces MHV practices.
Oh, okay.
If that's proven at the level of the Lagrangian, then it's guaranteed to work
That's exactly the point. They have done this really in four dimensions, so you really have to see how this works at loop level, where you need dimensional regularization or something else. I think, strictly speaking, that's only shown for a tree level.
Yes.
I mean, it might work, but I think more work is needed to really.
So you think that maybe the continuation of both Lagrangians to 4 minus 2 epsilon, well, if that can be done preserving gauge invariance somehow.
Yeah, but you would have to do that.
Then you can be sure that.
Because it's a bit fishy if you first work just in 4 dimensions and then you suddenly realize, there's an infrared divergence, you have to again continue to d dimensions.
Right.
You might again lose some information.
Right, somehow you have to show that dimensional regularization preserves the gauge invariance they are using.
Yeah.
Which is, dimensional regularization is good for those things.
Right? Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it keeps gauge invariance. But when you do this field transformation, like they do to eliminate the plus plus minus interaction, which then gives you the whole series of MHV vertices that might be modified if you have additional polarizations,
right,
if you work with d dimensions. But still might be worth looking at.
So to me, the key is you just replace this Feynman property by this other property. How this energy be entering the, confirm to the one loop or the
Well, for the MHV diagrams, I use normal finite propagators.
Yeah.
This was just a trick to prove covariance.
Okay, so.
But we didn't change the good old MHV rule. It just allows to decompose the one loop calculation into pieces which you more easily can identify as being covariant.
In general, if we do this, extend the current to the loss.
Sorry?
If you do, if you usually replace this thermal carbide by this retarded carbide, so you are the current to the loss. How, I don't see how can you get back.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So I mean, because so if you are a thermal carbide, you can do two parts. One is a retarded carbide, other is this thermal carbide.
Yeah.
Put the red in the covariant. And now because you just take one part of this, so now so the covariance is still there.
Oh yeah.
So I
think the compositions in terms of two terms which are set out the covariant.
Mm-hmm.
So which term generates completely?
Can you like it? Okay, can you have nothing to do with the covariance?
I mean, basically, if you have the bottom of the diagram, you write this.
Okay, yeah.
The one cut object.
This you can cut, yeah.
Plus two cut object and so forth. And once I put here this cut, that means it lacks of shell, so this is really a three level diagram here. In my method, okay, I use the MHV vertices and sum over all the MHV diagrams that contribute, well, have this cut. So then I get the three-level amplitude.
Okay, I see. Okay.
And then there's still an integration here, but it's a phase space integration. The phase space measure is covariant. That's why.
Oh, okay.
And then this applies
okay.
at a number of cuts.
Also, I don't see because how this still has nothing to do with super symmetry. So,
no.
Yeah, I mean.
That also means I get covariant expressions for the non supersymmetric and non spheric. But it doesn't mean I get all the terms. I can still miss covariant looking terms. Like rational terms, I don't miss. And these rational terms separately are covariant by themselves. This has more to do with dimensional regularization, that these MHV vertices are, strictly speaking, defined in four dimensions. And at some point, you start to miss terms in the expansion of the dimensional regularization parameter. And supersymmetric theories, this problem only kicks in at higher orders, but doesn't kick in finite order. That's why. Still works. Supersymmetric theories.
Can you say again the your last sentence? Can you repeat what you said?
Oh.
About supersymmetric.
Well, supersymmetric theories are this problem with missing certain higher terms in the epsilon expansion. That kicks only in at terms that have positive powers of epsilon, so terms that vanish in the four-dimensional limit. But the finite terms, which have like epsilon to the zero, they are correct.
So, yeah, in this case, there also is conform symmetry a lot. How come no conform symmetry? So.
I mean, this is it's closely linked to the fact that supersymmetric theories are 4D cut constructible, which was used by Byrne, Dixon, done by Kosova many years ago. So there they basically give a proof why this works in supersymmetric massless theories. For some reason, we needed to find D-dimensional MHV vertices that contain whatever that might be, which account for these missing terms.
So can this get some basic explanation from the topological ski side?
So
can this can be this assumption annual because it's purely kind of purely from the theory side. So, is there any can produce this from the from the topological string side.
Whenever
you put on D1 D5.
At the moment, we don't even know how to do one loop calculations in the topological string, so there's still some technology missing that.
Explain what is the difference between massive case and massive space?
Oh, in the massive theory, but this so what is precisely the question? I mean, we haven't found any MHV rules yet for massive theories. All this twister story came from a conformal theory, which by construction is massless. We don't know how to incorporate massive fields in twister space. But also a practical reason, well, at loop level, again coming back to this constructability, the ability to reconstruct a full amplitude just from the knowledge of the discontinuities. The reason is that any kinematic invariant can appear in these dilogs or polylogs, so they can fix by looking at the discontinuities or unitarity cuts to figure out all these functions. But in the massive theory, you will also get terms like log n squared. Now, n squared is not any kinematic invariant, so there's no unitarity cut, which allows you to detect this term. You will miss such things.